Warning, Star Trek From the Holodeck contains adult language and discussions. If you're easily offended, do not continue to listen.
Lock it alone!
Fire.
Holodeck 3 program is reinstated.
Open sesame!
Commander Klingon vessel. We are energizing transporter beam. Now.
Hello, welcome everyone to Star Trek From the Holodeck. This is Michael, your captain, and I welcome all of you to the USS Rain Man Digital. And on the bridge with me is my ensign, David. You know what? I think I should probably demote you to cadet. Just because you were zoning out right now.
I need to go back into Starfleet Academy.
David, I would kick you right out of there. Yeah.
Well, you know, see, that's the thing. I think I would function well on a ship with Aki because I'm like, oh, she doesn't care. Okay.
You need someone sensitive to deal with you?
I need someone sensitive.
I need someone to whip me into shape. Put Sisko in front of me.
Sisko would scare me.
That's what some people need. David, we've got a lot to talk about today. This recent episode of Starfleet Academy titled Series Acclimation Mill is very rich. There's a lot.
Ooh, yeah.
A lot there. And I'm going to try. We are going to try our best to make sense of it. Listen. I like the episode. I'm not keen, and this is just my own personal preference, David. This is my own subjective thought. I'm just not keen on the style and form of many of these episodes. But when I look at Star Trek, I review and talk about Star Trek, analyze Star Trek very differently than other TV shows and movies.
Yeah.
Because Star Trek functions as a coherent whole thematically. And I do feel like this series is largely hitting on a lot of Star Trek-ish type of things.
Especially the last two episodes. This particular episode that we're covering, and then the last episode we covered. I'm like going, wait a minute. Starfleet Academy came out swinging after, like, remember after the...
It took a couple episodes.
Yeah, the third episode, we were like going, okay, let's hope we get a rebound. Let's get a rebound. And sure enough, that was a heck of a rebound last episode.
I mean, it seems like we're on the same page. We're not super over excited about the style and form necessarily, but the content and what they're covering does, I think, gel with us because they're Star Trek themes.
Yeah, and it percolates our brains.
Yeah, and honestly. They're fleshing them out correctly. They're not doing it incorrectly or poorly. So let's talk about this episode more in depth. The synopsis: Sam, a photonic life form created by organics who never left their homeworld, confronts questions of purpose, agency, and meaning through an encounter with the legacy of Benjamin Sisko, forcing her and the episode to interrogate determinism, nonlinear time, and what it actually means to choose. See what I mean, Dave? By there, there being a lot.
There's a lot.
So we're given this week a very different type of episode, I suppose more reflective than the previous four episodes of Starfleet Academy thus far. However, very coherent with Star Trek's larger themes, and they're more philosophically loaded. At face value, this episode seems rather, if you look at just the veneer, simple, run of the mill. But when you start really paying attention to what's being said, specifically as you're moving to act three and four, the emphasis, the oomph of the episode really starts to come through. The episode doesn't necessarily move fast, but that's intentional because it's not plot driven. Interestingly, David, it's ontologically driven, meaning, and for those who are not familiar with such a term, when I say the episode is ontologically driven, I simply mean it is concerned with the nature of being itself.
Yes.
And for people that did not take an undergrad course in ontology, basically it's the study of what can exist or what does exist. So in this particular episode, we're not talking about plot mechanics or character psychology, moral lessons, or even world building logistics. We're talking about the actual nature of meaning, of being, of existence. They're going deep.
Oh, yeah.
They're not just doing first order ontology questions. They're digging into second order ontology questions.
And that's the impressive thing about like this particular episode is like it's very deceptively heavy where you're dealing with, especially with the fact that
I like that deceptively.
Main,
yeah.
Our main character, Sam, is this bubbly, jokey character that we got introduced to that was supposed to be fun and light and, oh, she's so different. But in this episode, once you start actually, once you let all of the, I guess you could say the rainbows and glitter of Sam just meld into the story, and it's covering real things and real philosophical things that Star Trek is based on. I mean, you brought up the big E word, existence. And what Star Trek fan doesn't realize that basically a lot of the stories of Star Trek, it does come down to purpose and existence. What is the meaning of it all? And every single Star Trek series has done that. And here in Starfleet Academy, that is supposedly for like a new fan base.
They take us very deep into those questions.
Yes. And I appreciate that because like, and that's what I think is like really strange about Starfleet Academy for me. Just like what you alluded to, it's not really written for me per se. It takes what a lot of people have said about Lower Decks and ramps it to 11. As funny as it sounds, because like I know people were like, well, Lower Decks isn't that great, David, because it goes over the top with certain things at times with its storytelling. And I'm like going, yes, it does. But the thankfully the part of Lower Decks is like it's an animation and it's easy to overlook it. Here, Starfleet Academy, they really try to push a certain elements that I see from Lower Decks.
Yeah, like Darum vomiting glitter.
Vomiting glitter.
Like stuff like that, I hate. Yes. I absolutely hate it. But because the episode is so philosophically precise, it more than makes up for glitter.
Yes. And that's the weird part about like Starfleet Academy up to this point is like, I'm like going, okay, it may not be a series for me, but my God, some of the content that they're dealing with, the substance makes me want to watch it.
If you're looking at the veneer, it just looks like a run of the mill YA story. But yeah, when you dig deeper, you go down to the symptomatic meaning, suddenly you start realize, okay, these are legit Star Trek stories.
Yeah.
All right, so I'll say this up front. This episode works best if you don't treat it, and I'm saying this for my own benefit, as lore maintenance or fan service. Sisko being included in this episode was not about answering questions, and I'm glad. Same I'm here. Absolutely glad. We don't need a 45-minute episode of Starfleet Academy answering such a big question like that.
Oh, please, you know, no.
Instead, they're using him not just as a love letter, overtly it's a love letter to Deep Space Nine, but he was also used in the only way you should use a character like this. If you're gonna roll the essence of a character out of mothballs, then you better use him for a powerful philosophical reason, and they absolutely do use him for that effect. He's used to dissect ontology. There are some issues. Some uneven character beats, a little clumsiness in delivery. And as I said, I'm not a fan of its formal properties and style, which is largely due to its just being the genre it is, you know, being a YA style series. But that is not to say its content and philosophical expressions are or were weak.
Yes.
This episode is, whether explicit or not, largely another existential episode. when you're dealing with notions of existence preceding essence, as we commonly get in Star Trek, Data is an example of that. Seven of Nine is an example of that. Sam is an example of that, that you aren't who you are prior to your existence. You become the person.
Yes.
The Doctor's reflections on loss, that was very subtle. Also, the return of Dax. I thought the symbionts died. I didn't know their life. I thought their life expectancy was far less than that. I knew they can live countless generations, but hundreds of years?
It is interesting that they bring this up. That basically, so essentially Dax is immortal.
Well, no.
because like she...
The symbionts have life expectancy. They're not immortal. So I'll have to look that up. I don't want to get into the...
It's one of those questions that had me in my brain, because that's what I thought at first was like, okay, so wait a minute. Are you saying Dax is immortal? Because that's not possible.
All right. So at its core, Sam's conflict here really isn't metaphysical. It's adolescent. And I don't mean that dismissively. I mean that very precisely. She was created by organics. She never left their world, and she exists under constant evaluation. What's important is that her creators don't actually ask who she's becoming. That's the point. They ask whether she's fulfilling what they already decided she would be. So the conflict is shaped as a bit of a metaphor. So, for example, it's shaped as parental guidance. And that's why I say that there's a lot going on in this episode. Overtly, that entire sequence between Sam and her people was essentially designed as a metaphor. It's this idea that children or youth often feel caged in by their parents' desires for them, their own goals, what they perceive is best for their children, what they think is beneficial, which does work with broader philosophical implications of purpose and choice and its connections to determinism. So the episode frames purpose exactly the way a teenager experiences it. You will become this once you prove you deserve autonomy. And that's why this episode particularly lands much harder than it initially seems upon reflection. Sam isn't rebelling against destiny in some cosmic sense. She's rebelling against predefinition, against the idea that her life already has an answer key, and she's just supposed to work backward from it. So you have an episode that is working on so many different levels. Remembering that this episode is structured, speaking in terms of genre, as a YA. So superficially, you have this idea that Sam, a child, is talking to her parents, much like Darum dealing with his own teenage angst. So once again, we're reminded about the things children go through. But when you start digging deeper, you start seeing on the surface, yes, we're dealing with teenage adolescence, superficially speaking.
Yes.
But when you dig deeper, you realize you're dealing with universal philosophical questions. And here we go again, David, with the E word, existentialism. This episode is also very clearly existentialist. Star Trek has broadly been existential in that it stresses becoming, notions of becoming, and of course the Edict slogan itself being a call to possibility, essentially an argument against closure. But after covering all of the Kurtzman era live action to date, his Trek does seem to be the most existential of all other Treks. And this isn't a negative. I think this is largely due to the times we are living in. Many in society have lost their path, their faith in everything.
Yeah.
We live in a post-truth society. Myth has largely kept society together. But what happens when our myths have been ripped from out from under us, which they have over the last, 50, 60 years? We see things very different now as human beings, particularly as Americans. So many of us are going through problems. you know, we've enlightened ourselves right out of purpose and emotional sanity. It's yes, true.
It's true. It's very true.
It's very true. So understandably, Kurtzman era Star Trek is largely covered with an air of existentialism. Even though I talked about that in Discovery, and we've talked about it throughout our discussions of Strange New Worlds, it wasn't until this episode that I saw this come through more clearly. Like, okay, in years down the road, when academics are writing about Star Trek, critics are writing about Star Trek, they're going to look back at Kurtzman era and say, well, this is what defines the Kurtzman era, is this, yes, this feeling of existentialism. And this isn't new to Star Trek. In fact, the very first movie, the motion picture, is considered a cosmic science fiction epic. Cosmic science fiction, because it's dealing with cosmic questions, philosophical questions of purpose and meaning, yeah, and existence. So it started off, the cinematic property of Star Trek started off as existential because of the time period that it was produced, which was the late 70s, which was another era of late existentialism. So it works. And this is why I always say, which is not new to any of the listeners that are longtime Star Trek viewers, Star Trek always writes, produces episodes right alongside culture, but not just culture, but the zeitgeist as well. The feeling of the era. So let's bring this back to Sam and what the writers were advocating now, because you can see that this alignment, everything they were doing with Sam, aligns with the existential ethos. Existence precedes essence, as articulated by the French philosopher, which we talk about quite a bit, Sartre or Sartre. And a moment ago, I said broadly existential, David, because I do not believe Trek was intentionally designed to be an existential project. It was a humanist project.
Yes.
And there are philosophical differences, but existentialism often leads directly to humanism.
Yeah.
Because once you deny pre-given essence, meaning has to be created through human responsibility, choice, and care for others. So I don't think this is something that deters from Roddenberry's original Star Trek. I think it's always been there in some way. All right, so let's bring it back to this specific episode. So when Sam said organics can't be predicted by algorithm because their purpose isn't understanding, it's becoming, it really brought the entire point to a head in the episode. That right there literally clarifies its existential dimensions.
Yeah.
And it also goes right back to Sisko. This is where Sisko comes in and why he's so often misunderstood. His purpose, what he's designed for in terms of writing mechanics. So Sam approaches Sisko the wrong way at first. She yes, treats him as a mystery to solve, right?
Yeah.
A destiny to decode, an endpoint to explain, almost like if she can figure him out, she can justify her own existence, essentially.
But yeah.
But that's the point right there. Sisko resists explanation. He's not there to clarify lore or tidy up canon. He's there to demonstrate something much more uncomfortable. That meaning is not something you uncover before living. It's something that only emerges through lived choices.
Yeah.
And that's why I was very pleased with how they brought the idea of Sisko back into Star Trek.
His legacy.
The legacy of Sisko back into Star Trek with the idea that he chose and was chosen. For example, this is where the episode does something very sophisticated, in fact, and I think a lot of people might have missed it, but from a linear human perspective, Sisko's life looks deterministic. He was foretold, he was awaited, he was named. That reads like a prophecy, right?
Yes.
But the prophets don't experience time, not the prophets, the wormhole aliens,
yes,
let's just call them. They don't experience time sequentially. That's how it was described in Deep Space Nine many years ago. They didn't even understand what linear meant. What happened yesterday is happening right this moment, and what happens in the future is happening currently. That's how their existence views time. They are almost outside of time. So in a non-linear framework, events aren't predicted or caused forward. They're co-present. So the prophets don't foresee Sisko's choices. They experience them.
Yes.
So what humans call prophecy is really just encountering a freely chosen reality from outside linear time. And that resolved the apparent contradiction. Sisko wasn't compelled. He could have chosen otherwise. And that's another strength of this episode, because the Dax character clearly stated that. Sisko's son, Jake Sisko, clearly stated that. Sisko was not compelled. He could have chosen otherwise. The reason he didn't is because he wouldn't.
Yes.
Not because he couldn't. His destiny did not override his choices. His choices are his perceived destiny. That's the interesting part about it. His destiny consists of his choices because they're happening in that moment.
Yes. And basically, it really comes down to the fact that, emphasizing that, Sisko wasn't forced. He literally, the reason why the things happened to him is because he chose it to happen. And when you think about like his story in DS9, that really is a core concept of Sisko's characteristic. He makes choices he wants. He never lets anybody else make that choice for him. And with Sam, especially when it opens up with how she perceives that, the fact that in the very beginning, this is her purpose. The alien species is sending her there for this sole purpose. And it does tie really nicely parallel-wise with Sisko, where it's like, the very beginning, he's being told, oh, you are destined. You are the destined emissary of the prophets. This is your destiny. But in the end, it's kind of like Sam figures out, no, you have a choice. You can do it. You can tell that's why I like the thing is where in the end of the episode, she essentially is like telling telling her creators or her parents, hey, I will tell you when the time is right.
Right.
I will tell you when I figure it out.
And she learned how to do that, and that she can do that through her study of Sisko, of seeking out the Sisko and trying to figure out what had happened to him. And she had assumed that, just like her, she had assumed two things. She assumed that she didn't have a choice, and she assumed Sisko didn't have a choice. And what she found out by the end of the episode is Sisko had choices, and I also have choices. So then that brings in story B very nicely, when you're dealing with judgments without context.
Yes.
And that's why this episode is very rich and very intricate, because every little thing moves into the next, just like the previous episode, where every single moment, even if it felt like it was distant or disembodied, it all was relevant to the overall story that was being pushed forward. We needed that with Kelrick too, because I feel like we can't have animosity forever. Animosity between children is one thing. So like the War College versus the Starfleet Academy. Okay. Competitive, you know, kids being kids or adolescents being adolescents. But you eventually need to have Kelrick and Aki come together, because this is Star Trek and people get along in the world of Star Trek. That's one of the core tenets, right? Of the Trek universe, is that crews get along with each other, I believe is what was the edict Roddenberry laid out, right?
Yes.
So bringing him into the fold, and then also describing why he's a bit of a jerk towards her, makes so much more sense than him just being a jerk.
Yeah.
The fact that he feels like Aki abandoned the Federation.
Yeah, after the burn.
That's an interesting story, because it shows his own disappointment. He obviously looks up to her, which is interesting. That's a really good character moment for me. Because outside of him being a tea lover and being kind of an asshole, I'm like, well, what is this guy about? And now we find out a little bit more about him and why he might have that animosity towards her, because he feels like, well, the rest of us stuck around and tried to make this place work, you left.
And it turns that almost like conflict, it brings a little, it shows the different philosophies between the characters, and they might be in conflict, but it's their philosophy that's in conflict.
Right. Yeah. So when it comes to Sisko, let's just wrap it up here. We also had that narration at the end of the episode. Now, we have said time and time again, because we're huge Sisko fans.
Yes.
We have had these discussions with other Star Trek fans, and you and I are usually on the same wavelength when it comes to this. We rather Sisko never be seen again.
Yes. Please don't. Don't.
Even though there's the Star Trek fan in me, you know, the teenager from the 90s that just, we want to see our Avery Brooks again. We want to see Hawk. We want to see Hawk. One more time. But then the realist in me, I don't want them to run the risk of doing what they almost did with Picard in season one of Picard.
Exactly.
I don't want them undermining the greatness with stupid modern day writing, thinking that, you know, these modern day writing styles that think, and the writers themselves that think they're going to do it better.
Yeah. It's very much now why I feel there's certain, like the captains, I don't want to see them now ever back.
Yeah.
I don't want to, because their legacies are already written.
Yeah, especially someone, I think Sisko is even in a more special place because of how his story ended.
Yeah.
And how if you decide to bring him back in some half-assed way, it would just unravel.
And unfortunately,
it would unravel at all.
Even if you were trying to bring him back.
Yeah.
The fact is how they actually ended his story. It is one of those times when I once in a while go back and I actually wonder if there's any other stories that some of these past characters can we can see more of. And Sisko is one of those ones that basically I'm like going, no,
I don't want it.
Where they left him
is perfect.
It is perfect.
Yeah.
Because if you
leave
bring
it alone,
once you bring him back, you bring up, you basically break all of the conventions that basically when he gets sent back, guess what? You have to explain, well, why did he get sent? Why is he here? Then you have to explain the time differential.
Yeah. Well,
of how long has he been in there?
Well, we know in the main timeline, right? In Prime Universe, if that's what we're calling this still.
Yeah.
He's still missing.
He's still missing.
If we go by the regular passing of time. But again, you have to remember, is he missing?
Exactly. Because like for him, he could be just stepping out of the portal.
He could step out and be right back with his son. Yeah. So that's why you have to be careful with this type of thing. So the way they did it for me is the best way to do it, because it honors his legacy without doing anything with it. Without trying to flesh it out further, they used it as a very clever plot device that helped us understand our characters while also filling us in a little bit that, yes, Sisko never returned after Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
If we're looking at this from a linear perspective. So the end of the episode is quite telling as well, and I'll tell you why. So first off, I would call this narration probably the ethical thesis of the episode. It goes, divine laws are simpler than human ones, which is why it takes a lifetime to understand them. Only love can understand them. Only love can interpret these words as they were meant to be interpreted. This is the episode's final position. Here, though, love is not sentimental. It is more of a what I would call a hermeneutical force. It's something to be interpreted. It's a interpretive mechanism, and it works because you have law, purpose, destiny. All of it collapses into relational understanding.
There you go.
Yeah. Judgment, context. So all of it falls right back into that relational understanding. So the way the end of the episode just brings everything they were doing, story A, story B, all together with a little bit of icing at the end of that works. Now, the only problem I have here
okay
is that I read it. I shouldn't have read the interview with Tawny Newsom.
I have to agree because
I don't really care about, I think it's called paratext is the term. I don't care about your paratext, meaning anything outside of the story itself, I refuse to accept is real. Do you get what I'm saying?
I don't
care about the interpretations of the writer. I really don't.
Because
we're the viewer.
We're the viewer.
Okay.
It's up to us to actually interpret.
So there was an interview done with Tawny Newsom, the writer of the episode, which I like her quite a bit, and she did very well with this episode. But what she said in the episode is telling, but also a little annoying for me. She said that the purpose of the narration was essentially to let the audience know that he had been listening to Sam.
I
don't want to know that. And also, I was okay with it, if it was because this was kind of a love letter and an honor to the legacy of Cisco in a lot of ways, I was okay with the way it ended with that narration. But if we are now to believe that that was actually a part of the story world, then I ask, where did it take place? This disembodied voiceover. You got to be careful with your voiceovers, because that is something that I've seen in the Kurtzman era that really gets under my skin. Star Trek has always used captain's logs, engineer logs for acting, first officer log, whatever it may be, as tools to push the plot forward, to get things going. Right?
Yes.
Okay. Basically, voiceovers. Diegetic voiceovers, not disembodied film noir voiceovers that we don't really understand or know if they're really that character talking or just this disembodied voice that is helping the audience understand the story.
Yes.
You have to be very careful. Now, in Kurtzman era, we're getting a lot more of that.
Yes.
We're getting a lot of disembodied voiceovers. And if they're meant to be logs, then you need to say that.
Especially at the end of certain episodes too. It's one thing if you put it in the beginning, like what you said, like old Star Trek always put that narration in the very beginning because you have the captain's log to explain what the scenario is.
And there were times, David, where they would skip captain's log. They would jump right into the episode where you have Captain Picard, let's just say, talking already in his, but you understood that it is the log. We don't really have that enough being instilled in these episodes to even understand if these are logs or just random talking. Like, for example, Sam, who is she talking to in the episode as she's walking around? Is this in her head? Is she now breaking the fourth wall talking to the audience? Because if she is, that's fucking stupid.
Yes. It's hacky.
Yes.
That is hacky. That is Marvel writing. That is Deadpool writing. And I'm sorry, that does not work in Star Trek.
Same thing happened in the last episode, but I let it go because overall the episode was great. When Captain Aki is talking, I assume it's her. It's her voice. But we know if you watch movies and TV, sometimes just because the voice matches the actor doesn't mean the voice is actually that character.
Yes.
This is why things start to get confusing. So in the beginning of episode 4, the last episode, Captain Aki is talking. It's written brilliantly. The whole idea of evolving and progress. But what was that? The camera was circling her on the bridge of her ship and she was just standing looking out the glass. Her lips weren't moving. So was this some recollection, you remembering a conversation she had? Is she doing a captain's log?
Is she doing a journal?
What's happening right now? I don't know. You have to let us know. So they got to get a little more strict with those voiceovers because we can't have a bunch of disembodied talking because then we don't really know what's what, what's going on, what's purposeful, what's simply plot device, what are we supposed to be paying attention to, and does it matter right now?
And yeah,
you got to be careful.
Oh yeah. And because like once you start actually doing these tropey writings, I mean, me and you have covered it multiple times in shows that have fallen apart where they rely on certain tropes of writing to get their story across. And it just, it ruins the immersion of your audience. You want your audience to be immersed in your story. Doing these things because it looks cool, or it sounds cool, or it's stylized.
You have to have a reason for...
You have to have a reason.
When shows break its form, you have to have a reason why.
Yes.
You can do it, but you have to have a reason why that form breaks. If the justification for the form of the episode breaking and its style is that this is happening in Sam's head, because we did see that when she communicates with her, let's just call them parents or her people, it's all in her head and she's taken to some other place, right?
Yes.
And we know she's still there because I think the last time they did it towards the end of the episode, the cadets, her fellow cadets, were frozen in place.
Yes.
So we get that something can happen in her mind, which would make sense. She's a machine, right? She's a photonic. That makes sense. So is that how the episode opened up as well? Was that in her head when she was talking to the camera? Was this all in her head? If it was, then it should have been explained a little better, because that's bad writing. You don't change your style of your show unless you give us reason. X-Files did this very often. Supernatural did it very often, where they would change their form and style, not just because they decided, well, guys, this week we're going to do this. It was written into the episode as to why the style changed.
And that's why, ultimately, too, is like why it's very dicey with the Cisco narration in the very end. Because let's just say, okay, all the narration up to this point has been Sam. Fine. We can go through that. But once you break it and you say, oh, here comes a narration by a different character, then you have to actually start explaining, why is that character in that particular character's headspace? Why is Cisco in the headspace of Sam? You can't, and that's why I was with you. I kind of let it fly because
that's the thing. Cisco wasn't even in her headspace.
Exactly.
We, according to Tawny Newsom, it was to let the audience know that he heard her. I'm like, okay, so who's he speaking to right now?
And that's why, when you first brought it up, I was like, I really wish Tawny Newsom didn't say anything. Yeah,
you know what? It sounds nitpicky, David, but these are the types of thing. If you want me to hate your show, these are the things you keep doing.
Death by a thousand cuts.
I will forgive the genre, because genre doesn't make or break a show. What you're doing within your writing will make or break your show. And even though you're covering very strong philosophical thoughts, right, David, that are very Star Trek eccentric, things that we're used to, that doesn't mean you can just throw your hands up in the air and say, well, we're covering this like Star Trek. This isn't Lower Decks.
Yeah.
I allowed Lower Decks to get away with a lot of their bullshit because it wasn't live action.
Exactly.
But you can't write this like it's Lower Decks. Lower Decks took a lot of liberties, things that would break the live action shows in half forever.
Oh yeah. You can't have like certain things in Lower Decks happen.
Yeah. If you break a show, I'm done. I grew up watching Star Wars. I love Star Wars. But when they broke it, and I'm not going to get into what series and or movie broke it, like literally broke it, where everything else that happened before, you're just like, well, what the fuck? That doesn't fucking make sense.
Yes.
I'm like, I'm gone. I don't care how much I love something. I'm done. So if they do that with Star Trek, David, it doesn't matter that I've dedicated my entire life to watching Star Trek. That's what I deem unenjoyable. If you break your show, I am done with it forever.
Because actually breaking, especially when you're dealing with something delicate like an IP, I know people might say, well, we could overlook a bad series.
I can't.
And no, because guess what? That IP affects, or that series affects the IP's mythos.
I'd rather a series be badly written, as funny as it sounds, than be illogically conceived.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. I mean,
I know that's, I don't want bad writing either, David, but bad writing doesn't break shows necessarily.
Well, that's why
stupid people break shows that want to do something innovative with something that doesn't need your innovation.
It's funny you bring up Star Wars as a parallel of this moment, because like the thing I'm hoping is Star Trek takes a lot of like what were mistakes of Star Wars and shows how to properly do it. And that's why I see with Starfleet Academy, honestly, is like one of the things that I wrote in my notes that actually dawned on me the second time I was watching this episode was like Starfleet Academy is what Star Wars was hoping for Star Wars New Republic. They wanted to actually bring in new fans, Republic. The New Republic with their books and everything, with introducing this YA genre of Star Wars storytelling and wanted the fans to embrace it.
You mean the High Republic?
High Republic. And essentially, Star Trek is doing that. They're trying to bring in this younger audience, bring out young storytellers with YA stories, but they're showing that you need to have substance with it to actually keep a lot of the Star Trek fans still engage with your product. And it's like funny that you bring up the parallel of Star Wars and Star Trek, because I'm like going, I'm hoping Star Trek doesn't fall into that parallels. And I can't see them doing it because they're so polar opposites of each other that I think it'd be funny if like the stuff that Star Wars wishes they got right, Star Trek gets it.
Yeah. Listen, don't break shows. That's the lesson.
Don't
illogical things. Like, don't be meta. Don't break the fourth wall. That's breaking the show. We don't exist in your world. I don't want to exist in your world. Well, maybe. But you know what I mean.
I know what you mean.
I don't want to exist in your story world.
Exactly. As a viewer, we want to be entertained by your world.
Yeah, I don't need you to pull me out by your cool little title sequence and talking to the camera. It's just, and you know why, David, I'm even droning on about this is because if it wasn't for that stuff, if I was judging this episode solely on its philosophical depth.
Yes.
And the balancing act that it achieved, I would have given this like a 95%.
Yeah.
But because of its style and form and the fuckery that you wrapped up all that philosophy in was kind of just silly for no reason, it's a 76% for me.
It's funny you brought that up because, yeah, this is why Starfleet Academy is so hard for me to watch. It's not that it's bad, because I could see the potential in it. And I could see that they're doing things that are actually really freaking interesting. The problem is like the form and function of it, I guess you could say, is just not my thing.
David, maybe they did say something at the beginning of the episode that I missed. I didn't watch this episode twice like I have been with the other ones prior to recording our discussion. Maybe they explained who she's talking to and why she's acting like that. But David, if they didn't, this is how easy it is to fix things like that. That entire bit of her talking with the title sequence could have been her report to her species.
To her species. Yes.
And then, justified makes sense. Perfect.
Yeah.
But lazy writing. If you want to be innovative with some smarts.
Yes. And that's why I'm with you.
Imagine if Next Generation opened up like this, David. Imagine Deep Space Nine opening up where Cisco. Well, let's be fair.
I was going to say.
One of the greatest episodes of all time. In the Pale Blue Light. Is that the name of the episode?
Yeah.
Is that it, David, with Cisco? But you know what? He's doing a log, isn't he?
No, he's doing a log.
That's right. And then because he deletes the log at the end.
Yes.
So he's talking to us, but he's not, because he's using a log. See, that's my point.
Yeah.
That's how you do it.
You can't use that as a bad example because the reason why was they explained it.
And then he deletes the log, right?
At the very end, he tells the computer, delete log.
Yeah. See, that's how you, that's, if you want to break the fourth wall,
that's how you do it. And that's why with me, you gave it a 76. I'm a little bit more lenient on it just because I really enjoyed how they handled everything. At the end of the day, when I watched it a second time, I go, okay, I could get behind this. I like the fact that a lot of the performances were fairly strong. However, form and function are important to me.
Yes. Everything else was good.
Yeah.
And that's why it hurts when I'm watching this episode. I'm like, this is really strong, but why? why everything else?
So that's why at the end of the day, my notes, I actually gave it an 85.
Oh, okay.
Because I'm not totally hating it, but that's the really conflicting part with me is like, we all loved the last episode because the way they handled the Klingons and everything else was very well done. And we gave that episode a fairly high score. But here's the weird part, Mike. For some strange reason, I like this episode a little bit more just personally because I like the times when Star Trek tackles those existential crises.
Yeah, the episode, everything else about the episode is fine.
Yeah.
The content was good.
It got me in the heart when, you know, you see Jake talking about his dad.
Yeah, it was good.
And I'm like going, oh man. So we all know now. For Jake, he never sees his father again.
I just, you know, Tawny Newsome is, I have a love-hate relationship with her because I think she's really great.
Like, I think so too.
I really do. Like as a person, like how she, at least I don't know her, but how she presents herself and how she talks about Star Trek, there's obvious respect and reverence for Star Trek.
Oh yeah.
And I respect that. If you're writing for Star Trek, you got to have that. If you don't, then I you probably shouldn't be in the writing room. But also, this isn't Lower Decks. I don't want Lower Decks shenanigans. And no now, David, it makes sense. Do you remember 2 years ago, it was announced that Tawny Newsome was producing an untitled Star Trek series?
Yes.
And it was going to be a comedy. This is it. I didn't even put that together until this episode. And you remember that I was annoyed with that announcement? Like, yes. Really? A Star Trek comedy show? Originally, she wanted it to be a variety show. I think this is it. I think this is the show.
I think this is the show.
It just ended up being a variety show.
And you know what?
Didn't she say something like that? Like, let me look it up.
I should have realized from the glitter vomit scene.
Yeah, see, even that, dude, really an alien species that vomits glitter? Really? It's fucking stupid. It's fucking dumb.
Yes, and I know a lot of fans right now are listening to us going like, well, David's laughing at it, so he must like it. I'm like, yes, but I like bad things.
You can like something and think it's funny and know that it also doesn't belong.
Exactly.
In Star Trek.
Yes. And that is a-okay, but yeah, it is. If you take a step back and you're trying to actually look at this critically, stuff like that really takes you out of the immersion. You know,
now maybe it's not glitter, David, like meaning in this real sense, maybe that's what Sam calls it, but perhaps it's something more scientific. Like what is glitter? Like I'm being serious, yeah. Ontologically speaking, no, for real. Like what is glitter made out of?
I have no idea.
Okay. So perhaps whatever its base is, its structural scientific base.
But even while you're looking that up, the one thing that also that I just realized too, is like when you get to story B with Aki and Kelrick, the whole idea that.
Okay, I have it here, David. So glitter is typically made of polyethylene and coated with aluminum. Okay, so if his species, that's what they excrete or that's what they vomit, is polyethylene with aluminum. Okay. and she describes it as glitter because it's funny, I'm okay with that. But if it's fucking glitter, like just glitter, there's no scientific like rationale behind it.
Yeah.
Go get fucked. Well, because that's forever in Star Trek canon now.
Yeah.
There's a species that vomits.
Well, Mike, even
vomits glitter.
Well, even Mike, if you think about it, like in story B, like I was going to bring up, was like they bring up a alien species that basically passes gas. There are a bunch of alien fish that pass gas. And it's like, I do feel like Kelrick sometimes at that moment.
I'm okay with that a little more. I mean, it is silly. You're talking about the vitus reflux?
The vitus reflux.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Yes. When you really start thinking about it, that's silly. And that's very much fucking lower decks.
That's lower decks bullshit right there.
But it was also, okay, there's a plant that it exchanges gas. Is that how they explain it? Yes. Okay, fine. That's still not glitter. It's still not biological glitter. Entities, organic entities expel various gases.
Yes.
Carbon dioxide, oxygen, so flatulence, okay, fine. Whatever. That I'm okay with. But glitter is the real problem, Dave. The real problem. Yeah. All right. Let's bring this show to an end before it turns into a hate train, because that's not how I felt when I was watching the episode.
No.
I actually enjoyed the episode quite a bit. But I also want to be honest. I want to be honest with how I felt about its overall style, its presentation.
Yes.
All right. Thank you, David.
Thank you. Live long and prosper.
I couldn't help but notice your pain.
My pain?
It runs deep. Share it with me.
End simulation.